to iDeveloper Live episode 5. Could someone in the chat room please confirm you can hear me? We've been having so many technical difficulties today. I'm surprised even my chair is working. So please, someone just type anything in the chat room to acknowledge that my... Oh, loud and clear. Thank you very much. Oh, good to... Oh, look at that. They're all flying through. Right, well, the technical difficulties with my screen and getting image merging all to work means that, guys out there, you're going to have to see me today. I'll better wave towards the camera. Where I have no idea where the camera is. It's somewhere around here. Means you're going to have to look at me rather than the logo as normal. My co-host, absolutely no idea where he is. Absolutely no idea. I mean, you just can't get the staff. So John's not around. We lost a guest or deferred the guest this morning. But Mr. Dependable is here, Mr. Kevin Hochter. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I've got my Depends on, so I guess I'm Mr. Dependable.
Okay, do you know what's just happened? I don't think anybody just heard you. Could somebody please confirm you heard Kevin? Ah, oh, they can hear you now. Excellent, excellent. I have no idea what's working here or not. No, someone can hear John. He's not even here. You can't trust this chat room, can you?
Now they're all just hearing things, so it really doesn't matter.
Right. Everybody out there now thinks you're John, Kevin, so you can say what the heck you like and nobody is going to care.
I could be disgusting and drunk and it'll be okay. That's nice.
Well, that's just John normally, isn't it?
Right.
Right.
You're missing people. That's great.
you see, there is a reason that I don't do a professional radio show. Nobody would have me because I haven't got a clue what I'm doing. Oh, right. Well, okay. It's good to be back after our break last week for Thanksgiving. Did you have a good Thanksgiving, Kevin?
I had a great Thanksgiving. Yeah, it was good family time and nice and quiet and wonderful here. How about you?
Yeah, we don't celebrate Thanksgiving here, but it was an okay Thursday. Just did normal stuff.
But you get American sales and stuff, don't you? Don't they bleed over there?
Yeah, that's right. So that's the good point. We still, it seems Thanksgiving sales or Black Friday sales or whatever they are seem to have become very popular. So did No Thirst Software run a Thanksgiving stroke Black Friday stroke? Did you go as far as Cyber Monday sale?
Yeah, we kind of did a Thanksgiving week to the end of November, so about a 6-day sale. It was really nice. It was. We just our own mailing list and something we produced. We didn't join up with anybody, and it was a good little boost for the end of the month.
So Thanksgiving sales, are they sort of always been a big thing in the US and even online, or is this a relatively recent thing to come to the online selling world?
I think online's been in the past few years. You know, the whole Cyber Monday thing is picking up speed. I think it's just a good opportunity for especially indies to kind of have an excuse to run a sale. You know, it's you don't want to be the kind of person that's always running a sale every other week, because then people will wait and buy when you have a sale. But you know, you can say, hey, it's the holiday season. It's Thanksgiving, or it's almost Christmas, so let's have a sale, and everyone can excuse that. You're not discounting. You're just having a normal annual sale.
Okay, I'm finding this very hard today because I'm suddenly realizing I am on camera and I can't pit my nose or scratch my ass or anything. So I'm just sat here like a zombie thinking, can I move? Can I move? Right, the chat room, a number of people in the chat room, and we like to listen to them. So someone says, Scotty, can you say stroke anymore? So stroke anymore. We like to fill everybody's desires. So there we are. Kevin, I just realized we've not actually introduced you. So there may be someone out there who doesn't know who you are. So just quickly tell us who you are.
I'm Kevin Hochter with No Thirst Software, and we make Money Well and Debt Quencher financial products for people.
That was too short. I was still taking a sip of my tea.
I see that. Of course you're on kind of delay here, yes. So I can't tell.
No. Yeah. You have to guess where I'm really at. See, because there's no point in me trying to demonstrate, is it? Because you're just never going to see it. Oh, no, you're listening to me on Skype, aren't you? So if I say now and put my hand up at the same time, you can see what the delay is.
Yeah, and everyone's probably fascinated at the stuff that they can't see us doing.
They're just listening in private conversation. Right.
That's right.
Okay. Let's do something for real, shall we? We're 7 minutes in and it's just been rubbish so far. So, worst guest we've ever had, really are. We're going to talk today a little bit about support. Now, you're one of the more successful indie software developers, and you've got a very large customer base. I won't ask you how large, because obviously that's probably confidential information.
10 or 12, at least.
10 or 12. With a product that's to do with home finance. And so you're probably, I must imagine, dealing with a whole range of users from tech-savvy to, this is the only product they're running on their machine because they just want to do finance. And so I'm guessing to you, support is a huge deal in what you do.
It definitely is. And since it's financial matter, since we're dealing with people's personal financial information, if you make a mistake, you're near Satan level. You've screwed up their life. You're touching their personal private data, and you've messed it up. So it's not, it certainly is a horrible thing when your Twitter app goes down, but it's even worse when you can't find the transactions you just put in last week. So if anyone has a problem, it's urgent. And a lot of the people that are using MoneyWell and Debt Quencher, maybe this might be their first real app that they're buying or using outside of the standard email and browser stuff that they have on their computer. So a lot of times we get the people that are real new to computers, or they've just switched to the Mac, and they're trying to figure out, why we're different, and why closing the window on MoneyWell doesn't quit the app and stuff like that. So yeah, it's pretty intense stuff with people's finances.
Right. So do you allow for that in your setting up for support, that actually, because of the nature of your software, this might be the first thing people have used outside of that experience, and therefore you might have to just be accepting you're going to be teaching them how to use a Mac full stop, or do you just tell them to go away?
We try not to tell them to go away. That would be kind of rude. But we do try to kind of give them some directions to go when they're looking at things, or if they're just starting new with a Mac, we kind of point them back to the Apple Store and say, hey, they got some really cool services that you can go in there and they can teach how to do things. Most of our customers are fairly good at using the computer, so it's not like everyone's a newbie, but we do try to give them some handholding if this is their first time dealing with something on a software. I think a lot of the problem that we run into is MoneyWell does some things a little different than other apps. It's more of envelope budgeting, and they may have used something like Quicken or Microsoft Money before. So we kind of have to teach them a concept as well as take care of their maybe technical needs or problem with the software. We also have to teach them how the concept of envelope budgeting works, which I think that's probably the trickiest thing and probably something we need to improve more in the software so we don't have to do as much tech support.
So you're basically telling me that you produce software on a platform that half your users don't understand, implementing a solution that most of your users don't understand.
Yeah, that's about right.
Right, so with that in mind, without necessarily going down into details, because we'll do that in a minute, what are your overriding principles of support? If you had to list down, well, our support must fulfill these things, what would you list top? What things would you list?
First of all, it was really important when I started this whole process about 4 years ago, that we be very quick with support. I wanted to be very responsive. So when I first started up the company, it was important to get back to people within a few hours, hopefully within one or two when I first started, because I didn't have that big of a customer base. And I was trying to use support as a marketing tool. So as quick as I could get back to them and as comprehensive as I could be with the support, that was really critical for me, because it was my marketing tool also. Our support really needs to be forgiving. If we've screwed up, if somehow the software is doing something wrong, we're at fault, you know, and basically if the customer did something wrong with our software, we're at fault. And it's because we didn't make the software, design the software well enough, or we didn't explain it well enough. It's you know, so it's basically we fall on the sword as much as possible and try to take care of the customer's needs without getting into a finger-pointing session with, that was your fault because you clicked the wrong button. You know, that's just not allowed. We somehow screwed up if they did something wrong, and that's kind of how we treat the support. It's got to be fast. It's got to be functional. Now, with the increased customer base, you know, it's not a 1 or 2 hour response time anymore. It's the same day, but we still try to be quick about it.
That's interesting. I was listening to Core Intuition with Manton Rees and Daniel Jelcutt recently, and I think it was Manton sort of said, well, I feel that, you know, these people are, they're used to dealing with the big software companies who are so slow and they don't even really expect a response. So as long as I get back to people, in a few days and definitely no more than a week, they're happy. Do you think that's probably because of the nature of his software isn't so life central, shall we say, and with your customers, because it's finances, you know, they would be really unhappy if it took a few days.
I agree. Yeah, that's probably it. You know, the software I'm dealing with is more sensitive, so I have to be and I have to be better than Quicken. I have to be better than the other products out there, or you know, they'll start looking back and forth and go, well, there's no difference here. And if they say, you know what, I've never gotten a response when I've asked Intuit for help like this before. I've never gotten this fast response. I'm shocked. This is stuff they're going to talk about to somebody else. This is the viral marketing. This is the word of mouth marketing that we've gotten over the years. And I think it's been well worth the pain of making sure that I take care of tech support on a timely basis.
I mean, I think there is for people looking to get into the software businesses indies, that's something to really consider. What are you developing? Because what you're developing will define the type of support that you're going to have to give. And I'm guessing that as your customer base grew, you were finding yourself, and especially, I guess, in the early days of the product when there were maybe more problems or you'd done something one way because you thought the customers would like it, and over releases you've had to change that. You were finding yourself doing, far more support than you maybe expected when you started, or did experience tell you were going to be doing loads?
I knew I was going to be doing a lot of support. This is my fifth company. It's not like I've just started out. So I knew that was going to be critical. And what I didn't want was, I didn't want support that was kind of just a scripted support. You know, it's the phone call is going over to India and you're going to go get walked through a script and they're going to tell you to reinstall Microsoft Windows at some point. You know, that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted it to be personal and interactive, and I wanted to make sure that that they were getting their questions answered. So that's why I handled support directly myself for probably too long. You know, I really wanted to make sure it was done right, because I felt like it was a critical piece of this business. Now, if I was doing something like a Twitter client, you know, I don't think it's critical if the Twitter client is down. It's annoying, but it's certainly not critical. And I understand it's probably Twitter. It's probably not the software itself. So, you know, there's a lot to excuse there. But if you can't get at your personal finances for 2 hours, that could be a crisis to you.
We had a question in the chat room. What sort of mix of support was it between, you know, what you would call tech support, dealing with issues in your software, and concept support, where people just don't actually understand the concept of home finance or the envelope system? I mean, do you have a feel for where that divide is?
I think that we have probably about half and half of trying to teach people how to do the conceptual part of the software versus how to work the actual bits and pieces of the software itself. So it's about half and half.
So I know that you spent quite a lot of time tackling the issue of concepts through producing videos on your website that explain concept, explain the software. Did you find that reduced the level of support you were doing, or did it just sort of increase it?
No, it was critical. That was one of the first things I chose to do in the beginning before I actually hired any tech support help. I decided I was going to do videos to help get the concept across, to help train them in a visual way. I think a lot of people are visual, and you can do as much as you want in a little text response to somebody or even talking to them if you're daring enough to publish a phone number. But I think that that the visuals help an awful lot, and that solved a ton of our support problems, or it at least gave me something quick to say, go look at this video or go look at these six videos and then come back to me if you think you still have a question. And it was a way to defer some support questions.
So by time, I mean, you've hinted already that you subcontract support out now, and I know that's been a journey and we'll talk about that in a moment. By the time you reach that stage of subcontracting out support, sort of what portion of your life was it taking up, and, you know, compared to being able to code or the other stuff the business needs?
I was probably spending about half hour, 45 minute segments of doing support maybe three or four times a day. I'd do a little bit in the morning. I'd go into code. I might take a bit of my lunch break and do some support, do some more code, and catch up with it at the end of the day, and then, you know, once before bed, just to make sure it was taken care of. And I tried not to interrupt code with it. You know, I tried to schedule it as breaks, code breaks, we're going to support, but it got to be more and more intense, you know, and the more difficult the support questions, the more your brain gets pulled away from what you were doing at the time. So if people are asking about how do I solve this financial problem, suddenly I'm into a, wow, my brain's got to really dig into this, and I've just lost my train of thought on development. And those are the things that really were dangerous. I started to see that I was getting pulled way too far away from the code. Not that it was taking up that much time, but my brain was, both brain cells were very busy on the support, and they couldn't be used for coding.
So, I mean, I think it's okay. Well, I hope it's okay if I say that, you know, you have a user base that's registered in, you know, in tens of thousands as opposed to thousands or hundreds. So, I mean, you've got a decent sized user base. You know, sort right. of how far into that, you know, sort of what sort of size user base were you getting to when you suddenly realized I can't do this anymore? Do you have any concept of that, or wasn't it really about volume? It was more about now the complexity of the product is, you know, could you tie the support up directly with volume of users, or was it complexity of product as it grew, or was there something else that just made you realize this is becoming too much?
I think it was the release cycle. You know, I was trying to put out bigger releases with more features in them, and every time you do that, especially if you're a one-man shop like I was at the time, there's going to be bugs, there's going to be problems, and your beta testers aren't going to catch them, and you might not be, you might be like me and miss a lot of bugs in unit testing. So what I end up with was a lot of support right after release, and that would kind of put me under for several days of I can't get back to the code. And if there were any new features in there, I had to make sure that I re-recorded my videos, updated all the tech support FAQs online. And, you know, the whole process of improving the front end of the support as far as video and text support had to be done too, you know. And so anything the new you built, you had to explain it to people in one way or another. And I thought, you know, every time I try to put out a big release, I get pulled away from the whole coding process. And it became a real struggle to try to put out patches as well as take care of the growing support. So I guess it's more of the audience was growing, but it's more of the audience at a certain size, you know, over over a couple thousand customers, suddenly every release caused a lot more support.
Okay, so when you began support, you began just with email support, yeah, email support at thothirst.com on the website. You know, how did that go? I know that's not what you use now. Maybe explain the journey you've been through a little bit on that. At what points and what prompted you to do what on that journey?
I started out with the email for a very short time because I really wanted to have some sort of forum. I think I was about 6 months into it, and I was really getting tired of the overflowing inbox and trying to make sure that I was taking care of the conversations. The hardest part for me was making sure the conversations were closed, and I really couldn't do that. And I jumped into I just went into Google Groups and started a group there for a while, and I tried to do it that way. And that helped. I mean, it was definitely nice to have it there, but it was still more like a list server where I was getting all the emails and I was still having to deal with that process. And I really couldn't. I wasn't able to defer the support process because my inbox was constantly being filled up, and I saw that. You know, out of the corner of your eye, you see the emails coming in. You're like, oh, God, I better get support. You know, and it was pulling me away. I was not the kind of person that could not have a badge on my mail app. So
yeah. So what sort of number did that inbox sort of unread email number have to get to up in the inbox before that was it? You had to stop coding and do it because you couldn't resist anymore.
It was probably somewhere in the early days. I'm more anal, you know, so I hate my inbox to have a scroll bar, you know. So if it was over, you know, 30 or 40 emails, I was freaking out. You know, I wanted to have mine down to inbox zero, or, you know, keep the emails for support at least down to five or six that were active.
Right. Okay. Sorry, I disturbed you. Can you remember where you were in your journey?
I can't remember where I am now, Scotty. I use Google Groups, like I said, for quite a while. That was my solution. You know, it was cheap. It was free. It was decent. You know, it had decent searches, and I didn't like a lot of the bulletin board systems that were out there. I thought, you know, they were kind of ugly and they were just they were too much maintenance for me. And so that worked for a while. I probably used that for, shoot, it was probably 2 years. I probably used Google Groups for 2 years to run my support.
So Google Groups got a conversation going because you thought conversation was important, but still effectively email you were having to deal with every single one. So what came next?
After that, I started looking at support systems like Fogbugs and Tender App because I wanted to find a place where not only the support was done in a closed box where it actually happened someplace and I could choose to look at emails or not, but I also wanted a place where I could hand off the support to somebody. I was starting to get the feeling that, you know, I had waited too long. I really should have had a support person, and for a while I even had my son, my oldest son, doing support. And but I needed to have a spot where I could say the discussions are open here. There is a person assigned to this support discussion. The customer is being taken care of, and it's either open or closed, and we can set it aside. And that turned out to be Tender. I decided to go to tenderapp.com, and that was my that was the time when I said, okay, now that I have this set up, now that I have a structure for support, now I can actually start thinking about seriously hiring someone to take this on and be my frontline person, so I don't have to deal with it throughout the day. I can deal with it whenever something's escalated to me, or when I have time at the end of the day to go in and clean up any support that's been left for me to do.
So, I mean, Tender app is a subscription service. So basically, it was moving from groups to something you had to pay for.
Correct. Yeah.
But I guess if you were at the stage of thinking, I actually need something where I can pay someone to do this to me, do this to me,
do this for me.
Do this. It's been a long week. To do this for me, then actually the cost of Tender app is an insignificance compared to the price of the person doing the support for you.
Yeah, Will Shipley was given a talk a couple of years ago at WWDC, and he kind of said it pretty plainly. He said, you know, if you're doing support and that's what you're spending your time during the day, then then your customers are getting cheated. They're not getting product. They're not getting new code, and you're losing money. And it made sense. You know, if I'm going to pay $24 or $25, $50 a month for managing support on a service, and it keeps me from spending even a couple hours a day in wasted time where I could be coding, it was just a no-brainer. I said, yeah, that's money well spent.
However, you were looking to offload the majority of the support altogether, because obviously your product was getting bigger, you needed to code more on it, you were already noticing the inability to keep up with release cycles. So how did you go about sort of that job of getting someone else involved? Because one of the things about an indie is you're so intimately involved with your product, and you know it. And one of the things, when a support question comes in, you tend to have an answer reasonably quickly. It may be a complex answer or need some research, but a lot of them, the low-hanging fruit, shall we say, is quite easy. So how did you go about making the decision of how you were going to bring someone else in on this?
I decided that I wanted someone who was going to kind of understand finances, personal finance, and who, you know, was well-versed in support. You know, the whole concept of support, some people just don't get it. They don't understand how to do it. And they don't understand that you have to be really nice all the time, even if somebody who you're talking to about a problem isn't being really nice. So I basically one day was I think I was just bitching about it on Twitter that I didn't have, that I was getting annoyed at still doing my own support because it wasn't working out. My son, well, he wasn't capable of doing it. He just happened to be available. So I really needed to go outside the family circle. And I got pinged back by Ash Ponders, and he said, that's kind of what I do, support stuff. And I went, yeah, that's probably a good thing. And I knew that he had done support for a personal finance app in the past. So it was a pretty easy decision at that point to say, yeah, I'm going to start paying this person to outsource the frontline support, the first level of it.
So Ash had never actually used your product, but it was the fact that he did support, so therefore he understood the concepts. He understood about, you don't tell him to go away using rude words just because they've asked you a stupid question. He did have some understanding, you felt, of finance apps because he supported one before, and that was more important, the most important things to you, because you felt he could get to know your software.
Yeah, definitely. And I trusted Ash. I mean, I knew him. When I first released Moneywell, Sean Riley and Ash Ponders were managing Money Dance at the time, and they were very nice. They were like, "Hey, welcome to the community, and it's good to see some competition on the block, but we don't feel like we're competition." So, you know, it's like we knew each other, and there was that understanding of I knew Ash was a very capable, very responsible person, and I wasn't going to be just throwing my customers to someone that I didn't trust or know.
So how does that work out when someone brand new takes on support? I mean, we don't want to make any personal comment on Ash or anything, and we know he's great at his job and a lot of people use him. But, you know, was it a case of how did you structure it? Did he sort of take the low-hanging fruit? Was that – sorry, someone used that term on the chat room, and so I've just repeated it about 9 times. Did he take the easy stuff that could just be done and then just – keep forwarding anything more complex to you? Did you expect him to actually to get in the software and learn and only come to you with really difficult stuff? How did you structure that initially?
Initially, I had him go through the support queue, and we discussed how to start it up, and a lot of this was his suggestion. He went through our history of discussions, and I think we had probably about 600 or 800 sitting there that he had to go through and kind of close out and get the feel for what we were doing and how we were answering questions. And it was basically a, here's how I'm answering this question, and he would learn from that process. And I didn't expect him to get in there and solve the deep issues that people had, but I really wanted him to respond to people immediately or as immediately as he could, because he wasn't just working for me. I mean, he has other clients. But I really wanted that. I wanted that initial response. I wanted them to know that something's being done. And a lot of support is basically telling people, we hear what you're saying. We're working on it. We'll get back to you. And you don't leave them in the dark for too long. And they're happy with that. You know, they just need to know that someone's on the job. So I needed him to be there and kind of frontline it for me and take the easier questions, take the computer tech questions, which I knew were no problem for him. And if there was anything that was specific that he couldn't answer, Tender has these queues, custom queues, and he would assign it to my queue. And once I get something assigned to my queue, I'd get an email. And I'd know that I had to jump in on it when I had time to go and support and do it.
Okay, so someone who's looking to outsource their support in that way, and I know, obviously, we don't want to reveal any personal details about a particular contract or anything, but should they be expecting to sort of be paying by the hour or be paying by the incident or, you know, just be paying a retainer? I mean, I accept you only did this with one person, and so you're guessing, but, you know, what should people be thinking if they're thinking they want to go this way because their support is reaching that level they can't keep up with?
Yeah, I've actually done it with more than one person, and it's typically an hourly thing, especially if that person is handling multiple clients. They're going to bill you hourly, and you have to work out how that hourly billing is done. You know, if they're billing you for every minute, or if they round it up or down to every 15 minutes, or how they do it, and they should be able to give you a detailed report of, you know, here's my. They should be using some sort of software to track their billing process and just be able to give you a quick invoice however often you want to do it. I like to pay invoices twice a month. And, you know, here's the hours I put in on the days I put them in, and, you know, you pay it.
Okay, so you ran that for a while. Maybe you can comment on how long later on. But then you felt you needed to change again. So, you know, what was it that you were looking for more than what you had?
When I decided to, I wanted to step back even a little bit more from the support process. So, what I wanted was someone that was very intimate with Moneywell, and, you know, sometimes your best resources are right there in your customer base. And I talked to Dan Wood at the same WWC a couple years ago that I was deciding to add a support person. He was talking about how they used a customer or a couple customers for their support process. And I found a customer of ours that was really good at answering the questions. In fact, she would correct me sometimes in the way I answered the questions. So I knew I had someone that really understood Moneywell in depth. And so I asked her, I said, what is your current position? What are you doing right now? And she says, well, I'm doing, you know, IT support for my company. I said, well, do you have extra hours during the day? Then instead of doing it for free and answering customers' questions every so often, how about doing it, you know, on a regular basis and being contract labor for No Thirst? And she was... you know, she was up for that, and so it was the difference between having someone that was really good at the technical support issues and the level one stuff, and someone that would be able to take some of the level two or level three support and handle some of the trickier questions, and then basically just confirm with me, did you like my answer? You know, the one thing I like about Tender's site is they have internal responses to a discussion. So you check a box and you can have a discussion with your support person without the customer seeing. And so you can ask questions, you know, did I answer this right? Is there anything else I need to add? And so basically that's what Tamara started doing. She was going there, answering the more difficult questions, and then just confirming with me, you know, she'd put it in my queue, make sure I did this one right, make sure you don't have anything to add. And it was, again, a learning process. You know, anybody that you hire to do your support is going to have to learn your app, and it's going to take time. So, you know, if you can get someone that knows a little bit about it, fantastic. You know, you just got a free few hours of training you don't have to do to somebody.
So basically, because you had the forum set up within Tender, you were able to identify people who were already active, obviously quite enjoyed it, were giving good answers. And so basically, she found herself for you.
Yes, definitely. You know, I knew that I knew to look out for customers that were really good at stuff, and I asked a couple before her what their status was, but they really weren't excellent at answering the questions like she was. And what I was looking for was someone that had the skill to be able to reading for comprehension, to understand what people were actually asking. I think that's a really tricky skill when you're doing tech support. Because I think I'm pretty good at it, but sometimes I just fall down and I didn't quite hear what they were asking, and so I'm answering the wrong way. Then they come back and say, no, I meant Z, not A. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, oh yeah. So someone that could actually really comprehend the questions and give a very intelligent answer, those stood out. And there was only a handful of people on our forums that were actually doing that. And they're very generous with their time too. You could see the people that were jumping in and trying to help other customers on all the public discussions.
So, since beginning this support journey, obviously, you know, because you wanted to be doing more coding and you were doing support, as a company, you've now got, you know, extra developers on board. In fact, you've just taken another developer on in the past week. Or 2 weeks, whatever it is. So I'm guessing that means that you're not necessarily intimately involved in every aspect of the product anymore, even just yourself. So how has that affected the way you support the products or have to support the products by the fact that it's now a development team as opposed to you?
It's actually been... it's been a good process. I brought on Michael Fay in the beginning of this year, and he was writing our iPhone product, Moneywell for iPhone. So when there were support issues that had to do with syncing or the iPhone app itself, he was actually someone that we could escalate support to. And although I was maybe a step back on understanding the answers, some of which he could give that I couldn't give, you know, I had to treat myself like anybody else and kind of learn from the people that knew the answers and get better at the answers myself. So I guess what it is I'm not as I don't know every line of code and I don't know every single detail, but I do understand the product more intimately than anybody else. So I'm still there as the support person that can answer the concept questions before anybody else, and there may be a technical issue that I need to escalate to someone else at this point. But you know,
so you're the Moneywell daddy, and no one's going to replace you
for a long time. Yeah.
Who's your daddy?
Good daddy.
A question that sort of came up on the chat room a little while ago, but just didn't really fit where we were at the time. Do you ever consider checking about people's licenses before doing support, or do you just assume everything's okay and get on with it?
I've only done that a couple times when someone has asked very weird questions. Like I really even wonder if they're supposed to be in our forum at all. But most of the time I just answer the questions. I'm assuming that they're customers, and I haven't found anyone that wasn't when I've had to go and look up a license for someone, or you know, someone has an issue that's deep. I mean, there might be some people on our forum that are actually pirating the software, but I just haven't bumped into any yet.
And life's too short to chase them. They're going to do it somehow anyway. So,
oh yeah, definitely.
There we are. Right. Well, it's been great chatting about this. Is there anything else about support that you just feel that, you know, if you didn't say before the end of this conversation, you'd just be incomplete and you know, would not have fulfilled your responsibilities?
I think it's just that to make sure that you don't have to be at the front line to understand what your customers are doing. You don't have to be the only person answering support. I think that was my biggest fear, was that the minute I start handing off support, I suddenly wasn't going to know what my customers were doing with the product, and I wasn't going to know the problems. But that's not the case. I mean, it really does float up. I do hear about the problems. I do get things escalated to me that are issues, and I have asked Tamara and Michael, whoever is grabbing onto a support issue, if there's anything that's looking like a trend or any issues here that we need to handle, you know, make sure I'm clued in. So you don't lose that. It's up to you to keep in touch with the customers, and it's okay to have someone doing the front line. You won't lose that personal connection.
How closely related is your sort of support program to the whole aspect of deciding features for the next release or identifying bugs in current releases?
It's pretty high on the list. We definitely try to track our bugs through our tender support. We use Lighthouse, which is a companion product from ENTP, and as issues are brought up by customers, we can attach Lighthouse tickets to it, and we do that all the time because we want to know, even if we don't plan on putting a feature in the next release, we do want to know that customers have asked for it. So we tend to create those tickets all the time from our support forums, and if there's bugs reported, we're also creating tickets and trying to make sure that if a customer had a problem and we fix a ticket, that we can go back and ask them, is this better for you? Did our solution work? And kind of do follow-ups on customers' issues.
All right. Well, Kevin, it's been great speaking with you. Thank you very much for coming on. We want to try and stick roughly to our new 45-minute format, so I'm going to call that to a halt there. I'm going to bring you back in a minute just to remind people of who you are. But we better first thank the sponsors of today's show, REM Objects, REM Objects Software at www.remobjects.com. Now, it's been a big week for them as well. I think it was this week, or was it the end of last week? Anyway, it's been recently. They've just done their winter 2010 releases, where they've got new versions of their data abstract and their REM Objects SDK products out. Loads of new features, loads of extra stuff. That's not necessarily going to make any sense if I just read it out here. But the REM Objects SDK is all about remoting. The data abstract product is all about briefcase modeling data for offline and online support across multiple platforms. So please just go look at their website, especially if you're thinking of doing anything related to this, then you definitely should, because as I say every time, writing this stuff yourself is just a waste of time, and you know, unless there is something so specific you've got to have that no one else does, because it's, you know, yeah, these guys have got years of experience in making this stuff work. But please also check out their website anyway, because they're our sponsors and we love them, and they have supported us since day one of the show. And we love the guys at REM Objects, and we just want to say REM Objects, REM Objects, REM Objects. Everybody loves REM Objects, because it's been a while since we've said that, and we just should. So there we are. Right, Kevin, do the sales pitch.
I'm Kevin Ochter. My website is nothirst.com, where you can find Moneywell and Debt Quencher from Noether Software. If you want to learn more about the way I've been running the company, you can look at my blog, kevinhochter.blogspot.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at Kevin Hochter.
I have to say, your blog is always really well written and with really well thought out articles.
I've got a few that are in the draft bin that I got to get finished and get out there, because I promised people some follow ups to my last one, so they should appear within the next week.
Great. Right, I'm just going to do a bit of a pitch here. Scotty from iDeveloper TV, video training, Objective-C course was the last one we released for those still looking into it. Hoping early next week, maybe by the time you listen to this, our new iOS development course for developing for the iPad and the iPhone will be released with Dave Vuer. That's great. All the details will be on the website soon. Really comprehensive, takes you through from sort of knowing nothing about iPhone development to getting an application out there. So keep an eye out for that. Please, 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 can we have some more comments on iTunes against iDeveloper Live? I haven't forgotten what I said about giving some giveaways to people who've done comments. That's still valid. So if you put a comment up there, please send me an email telling me what the comment was so I can relate it to you, and we will do a draw for some product giveaways, shall we say. And on Twitter, you can follow iDeveloper TV if you want to know about the courses that are coming out, and if you want to follow my ramblings, I'm MacDevNet. Now, I don't know if I should do this. I know I'm going to anyway. You know, I have something like 1,800 followers. I'd love to reach 2,000 by the end of the year. Come on. There's got to be over 100 and 200 of you out there who really just want to hear the crud that I put out there. Just subscribe. 1st of January, go away again. Let me be at 2,000 on New Year's Day. Please? Please? Does that sound too pathetic, Kevin?
Not at all. Not at all. Good begging.
Thank you. This has been iDeveloper Live. It's been great for you listening. Thanks to the chat room. Until next time, all of you, take care. We'll be right back.